Blog Talk Radio.
We are the heirs of that first revolution.
Will a strong and united America still be a force for freedom and prosperity around the world?
America has created the longest peacetime economic expansion in our history.
We are the heirs of that first revolution.
Good common sense and sound judgment of the American people. And their essential love of justice.
Hi, welcome to Kudzu Vine for April 21st, 2024. I'm your host, David McLaughlin. Joining me as always, welcome Catherine Smith.
Greetings from Atlanta.
And welcome Tim Shiflett.
Good evening, sir.
All right, exciting show tonight. We've got a lot of topics we're going to get into, but at about 20 minutes into the show, we're excited to welcome in, for I believe the third time, Mr. Dante Cheney of American Communities Project. He's involved in Michigan State, NBC News, Meet the Press, Wall Street Journal, an amazing political researcher, and really, I guess, cultural, social researcher with that American Communities Project, because they actually glean data that you could set, you know, Democrats and Republicans aside, and it would still tell you about Americans. So we're going to discuss that and some more recent work with Dante here in just a little bit. But until then, we're going to talk about the subjects of the day politically. And the first one we're going to discuss is there were, I guess, three separate pieces of legislation voted on. All three passed, I guess we'd have to say, in a bipartisan fashion with a lot of Democrats and a lot of Republicans voting for them and a portion of Democrats voting against some and a not insignificant portion of Republicans voting for at least some and some voting against all three, even though the measure was pushed by through with Republican Speaker Mike Johnson's support. Tim, you watched a lot of this all day on Saturday with the votes. Kind of tell us how all three broke down and lay more flesh on the bone for us.
Well, first of all, there were four votes, not three. The first one had to do with TikTok. You know, there's been a lot of stuff going on about that, and the House voted to either require China to sell it, and if they didn't sell it, to ban it. And so now that goes over to the Senate, where it faces an uncertain future. That one being said, I personally did not think, say, a month ago that we would ever see any vote on funding for anything the rest of this year, especially Ukraine. I think the Speaker probably chose the best of his options, and none of them politically for him were good. So he got this funding done, but he needed Democratic help to do it on every vote. Of the four bills that passed, the Taiwan Asia funding drew the least opposition. I think there were 33 Republicans that voted against it. Everybody else voted for it. And the Ukraine funding drew the most. A majority of Republicans voted against it. But it still passed fairly easily because just about all Democrats voted for it. The Senate's going to vote on the package Tuesday. It's expected to easily pass, and that's how the voting went yesterday. The other big question was whether Marjorie Taylor Greene was going to do anything in the way of a motion to vacate, but she held it, even though she blasted the Speaker, and we'll get into that in a moment. So that's where we are. There's funding coming down the pipeline for Ukraine, and I hope it's not too late. We'll just have to see.
Well, now, the TikTok bill, we've discussed that before, and we'll discuss it again, and probably there's a whole social media and how young people should be discussion with Jonathan Haidt's new book that we'll get to, but I really know that a lot of this centered on the foreign aid bills, the three of them. Catherine, your thoughts on, you know, what went down on Saturday?
Well, you know, I'm relieved that they got something done, because it's so important, really vital for Ukraine to get the funding. I'm sort of constantly frustrated by this back and forth and, you know, infighting. But that's the way it is now. Like, it's just the way it is, so I should not be frustrated by it. And Marjorie Taylor Greene with her, you know, motion to vacate, you know, it's like she's just holding that up like some kind of, you know, threat, but she really doesn't have anything to back it up with, I don't think. Because I think that, especially with this new, with this bill being passed, I think, we'd have to wait and see, but I think Mike Johnson has some support from the Democrats, so that if they do set up a motion to vacate, I think he's protected. There's a handful of, you know, there's some Republicans, and then I think Democrats will step in to protect him as well. It seems like, of course, that can change in a moment, but I'm just glad that I hope we can get that money over to Ukraine and help them as quickly as possible.
Yeah, I guess I heard that President Zelensky of Ukraine said that now that the funding's been put in, they feel they have a chance. I mean, unfortunately, it wasn't like this money is going to tip the balance. We feel like we're going to, you know, win this war, but we got a chance, which
right.
I just sadly have a feeling had this money come along 6-9 months ago before they almost ran out of bullets. At times, then ammunition, then they might even have more than a chance. But I guess better late than never. Tim, this bill, why do you gather that Mike Johnson chose this as a hill to die on in a lot of ways? I mean, he may not lose his speakership over this, but he definitely expended a great amount of political capital.
Yeah, he said that what changed his mind was the intelligence. You know, he gets a lot of the top intelligence that you know, the president would see, and that others that have top secret clearance and better get to see, because he's second in line to the presidency. And he saw the latest intelligence, and he saw that if we did not pass this, that Ukraine was probably going to lose this war by the end of this year, if not sooner, because the Russians are expected to start a major offensive here in the next couple of months. And then he's got her threatening him. And if it wasn't this, it was going to be something else. She was going to hold that over his head the rest of this year. And I think he finally decided, well, you know what? If I'm going to go down, I'm going to go down this way. And plus, I believe that there is probably been some conversations between him and the Democratic leadership, and perhaps the White House too. And his job, I'm thinking, is safe for the rest of the year. Now, after the November elections, all bets are off when they caucus and choose new leadership. But he is going to have to depend on Democrats to help him keep his job. There are three that we know of now that are all in favor of removing the speaker. And I think one more thing helped him. Trump's announced his support of Johnson We saw it on TV down there at Mar-a-Lago. And I think that's why she hasn't made a move, because for the first time we see a little daylight between her and Trump, and she don't want to be there.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see how this whole thing plays out. I do wonder, you know, like all these folks that voted against the Ukraine funding, you said a majority of Republicans aren't smart enough to know that, okay, if Putin takes Ukraine, then he's going to go to the next place, whether that's Poland or Finland. And at some point, if you don't stand up to him, you're going to have to draw a line in the sand, unless you just don't care if there's a line in the sand, and you're just like, I don't care if he takes Europe. What exactly is the end game for all these folks, Catherine?
Well, I heard I read a little bit about Mike Johnson's, you know, decision to support the funding, and he said, or I don't know if it was a quote or, you know, someone attributed it to him, that he decided that he was going to do the right thing, whether it was the right political thing or not, but he prayed on it, and this was what he thought was the right thing to do. So if more people could contemplate these decisions in that way instead of whether it's the best political move, I think we'd be in a little bit better shape. But you're right. I don't think they don't have an end game. They're just – they play this hand. They don't play the game. They play this hand. And this is the hand they want.
Definitely.
Yes.
Definitely that prayers and action are better than thoughts and prayers.
David,
tell us about these folks that voted against him, these Republicans.
Well, I think at least a portion of them, if there's one thing that they all know how to do up there, or should know how to do, is count. They all went in knowing that these bills were going to pass yesterday. They talk among themselves. They also see some of what's going on the other side. They saw that Democratic leadership had come out strongly in support of these three bills, which means they'd bring enough Democrats along with them to pass anything that needed to be passed. So I believe that some of them made a little political move. They voted against it when otherwise they might have voted for it. That way they got two things they wanted. It passed anyway, and they didn't have to get blamed for its failure. And number two, they stayed on the good side of the big orange man down at Mar-a-Lago, who, of course, was opposed to all of this. I'm sure Trump would have supported the funding for Israel, but other than that, I don't think Donald Trump cares anything about Asia, and you know how he feels about Ukraine and what he's going to do about Ukraine. So I think a lot of them played the old have your cake and eat it too thing.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point.
Yeah, well, speaking of Donald Trump, let's use that as our transition to the next topic. He's civil trial related to the hush money case in New York and Manhattan started this past week. And while there's a lot of, I guess, legal ramifications, it's something that is taking up, A, his time, and, B, giving him bunches of negative attention, including, you know, it's not televised, but apparently if it were, it might be one of the greatest cures for insomnia we've ever heard of. Because that's, I guess, the most damaging reports, the fact that he supposedly has gone asleep during the trial not once but twice but three times this week. Catherine, how bad a week has this been for Donald Trump with this trial?
You know, there's this adage that all, you know, attention is good attention. And I think this is the exception that makes the rule. because I don't think this has been good for him at all. I guess he's been scowling and muttering and staring down jurors and doing all the wrong things to be a defendant in a case with a jury, right? Like, we've all watched the police and courtroom dramas. We know that the defendants that just remain calm are the better defendants. And then you make – it's a great point that he can't really go anywhere outside of New York during the week because he's got to be in court every day. And he's not going to win New York. His campaign is claiming that he's going to really make a push to win New York. There's just no way he's going to win New York. Nobody in New York likes him. He lost by 70 points last time. So he's losing. And meanwhile, Joe Biden is, going all over the place. Now, Joe Biden isn't getting as much, public attention, but he's on the ground talking to people, making an impression, not, in the courtroom making a fool of himself. So while it might not be getting as much, television or news coverage, it's still, good move for President Biden to be out there, talking to people and working those swing states. So, but yeah, this is the exception to the rule.
Yeah, well, and President Biden may be actually in the White House as much, if not more, time than Donald Trump is in that courtroom, but he's doing the people's business, not handling a civil trial related to hush money case on affairs. And it is plural from what I understand, while his wife was pregnant with, Barron at the time. So this is something that happened quite a while back, but the hush money part of it just came out much more recently than, 18 years ago. Tim, give us your thoughts on, politically, how bad is this for him?
Well, it's not good for him. Catherine did mention the one downside of this, I think. Donald Trump still, good or bad news, he's still dominating the news, and it's taking attention away from the good things the president is doing. It's taking attention away from his campaign events. It's taking away news away from the good things he's doing when he's doing the people's business in the White House. So Donald Trump is still dominating the news. This thing, man, it's like a, I don't know. This thing looks, in some respects, like a mob or terrorist trial or something. Because this guy believes he's above the law, and people are being intimidated by him. I think a lot of people that would have liked to have served on the jury saw that it was his case, and they just said, "No, can't do it now." On the downside for Trump, this falling asleep in court you mentioned, David, that's making him a punchline for the late night comics. If you're a politician, you don't want to be the running joke of late night comics. He's not on the campaign trail much. That's bad for him. And another thing, if people are getting a good look at him right now, he just doesn't look like the same person that he was, say, even 4 years ago in the last campaign. He looks old and tired right now.
I want to make a little correction there, David. This is a criminal trial, not a civil trial.
Right.
Said it was a civil trial, but it's a criminal trial.
Right. And I believe we might have lost David.
Oh.
So I'm going to keep talking here. the jury was chosen much quicker.
Yeah,
than
I
many
was surprised.
Experts thought.
Yeah, I thought it would take longer.
Yeah, well, a lot of experts thought that too, Catherine. Are you back with us now, David?
Oh, I am. I'm doing my producing business. You know how I have to be the producer as
well.
So that wasn't me just dropping off. Yeah, no,
oh, I was
we're not ready quite yet, but we're getting there. We're getting there. You know, the thing about the sleeping is, you know, I made light of it, but this is something that he used to attack Joe Biden, sleepy Joe Biden.
Right.
He did it for all of the 2020 campaign, and it maybe had some impact on Joe Biden. Well, now he's doing the exact same thing in court that he's accused Joe Biden of being, you know, being susceptible to in a very public manner. So I just can't think of few things that he could do that would hurt him this week more than that. But right now we want to pivot and welcome into our guest for about the third time onto the Kudzu Vine from American Communities Project, Mr. Dante Cheney. Welcome, Dante.
Oh, hey, how y'all doing?
Oh, good to have you on again. Well, Dante, we know this American Communities Project, we've talked about it before. It's been going on for several cycles now. You had a set of counties, swing states. One included Tim's home county of Chattooga County, but you switched to some other counties this time. And so tell us some of those counties and what you did to choose those as being reflective of the 2024 electorate.
So the ones they've picked this time around, and I don't have as much of a hand in that, my concern with the ones they've picked, because I didn't get a chance to do it, is there is no Chattooga in there. There's nothing that really represents that part of the electorate. The frame they're using this time around for that, and it's NBC doing it, is they're trying to pick swing counties, which honestly I think is I don't approve of the approach, frankly, because I don't think this is a swing election. I think this is a base election, and I think this is where we've been now for the past several cycles. And it really comes down to, yeah, there are always some counties where it's like you want to win the closely contested places. I understand that. But it's just as important, for instance, think about Wisconsin. Democrats need to get the vote out of Dane, you know. That's really what's going to matter to them as much as it is trying to win Ozaukee or these counties on the southern edge of the state. And to me, that's the thing that's going to matter most. We always have to talk about swing voters. There's this mythical group of voters that could go either way. There just aren't many of them anymore. And frankly, it's just as important, I think maybe even more important, to get your base out and to make sure you're getting your base out. And I think that's Democrats are really worried about, particularly with younger voters, with African-American voters, and I think to some extent maybe with Hispanics as well.
Yes, that is a very astute point you made. And so since we're a Georgia-based show and the three of us are more likely to have been in Gwinnett County than probably some of the other counties, tell us what you're focusing in on in Georgia with Gwinnett County.
Well, Gwinnett is key, I think, in part. Look, Gwinnett is almost certainly going to go Democratic at this point. I think we can say that. Cobb and Gwinnett have become the hallmarks of really that type of county, which is this dense urban suburb, as we call it. It's become really a crucial part of the Democratic electorate and running up margins there. So I think in a place like Gwinnett or Cobb, the key is going to be running up the margins, getting the margins back to where they were in 2020. It's not going to be enough to win those places. It's you know, as it often is in elections, it's about how much you win and buy, right? Whether or not, and I think when you look at the 2024 election, you know, Biden's biggest opponent, you know, obviously Trump is a huge opponent, but the biggest opponent for Biden may be the couch, getting people off the couch and getting them into the voting booth. That's the real challenge for him. Like, if he can get the people enthused the way they were in 2020, he can win this race. And again, I think it's less to do with the excitement about Joe Biden than it is telling people in a lot of these communities, because they're not, I don't think they're massive Biden supporters, but they look at Trump and they don't want that. And I think that is the real challenge, I think, for the Biden campaign, as far as I see it.
Yes. Well, I think Gwinnett obviously is one to watch with about a million people. It's so big, too. I will tell y'all this. The one to watch as far as which is that next metro Atlanta County to flip, because it seems like every cycle one flips. It started, you know, 20-plus years ago with Clayton, then Douglas, then Gwinnett was somewhere in there, and Henry. The next one's Fayette. Fayette was just barely held by Donald Trump this past time, and it could flip. And if it flips, that's a sign for Georgia to go one way. If Donald Trump's able to hold it again, it may be a sign the other.
I think that's I think it's a really good point. That's a key county to watch. The other thing I'd say is you have all these ex-urban counties kind of on the northern edge, right, of the Atlanta metro is freaking massive. But I mean, like, I don't even know if it is the edge, but the outer ring, maybe we'll say, like Cherokee County. These counties, Donald Trump will win these counties. But the question is, does he win them by 20 points or does he win them by 30 points? And, like, that's a significant difference. Or does he win them by 20 or does he win them by 25? Especially in a state like Georgia that is so close. The flipping matters. But just as important, I think, is holding down, if you're Biden, holding down the margins in those places, and if you're Trump, he's trying to hold down the Biden margins in places that matter. And like those are going to be things you're going to want to watch, I think, on election night. And I think before election night, just to kind of gauge enthusiasm and where people stand as we work our way through the summer.
Yes. Well, we've talked about my home state, Tim's home state. Now I want to ask you a question about yours and Catherine's home state, that of Michigan. My take on it from never having lived there is it's really become Democratic. And if you didn't have a large Arab American population and you didn't have a situation in the Middle East, I would feel very confident about Joe Biden and the Democrats winning it. But that does create a bit of a wild card. I guess it's in Dearborn and maybe a few other places in suburban Detroit. As a native Michigander, what's your take on the situation in Michigan right now?
So I think, look, the Arab American story, obviously, you know, the terrible story that is unrolling in the Middle East right now around Israel is, and the Gaza Strip is terrible. It's awful. It's a horrible story. But I do think that it's been overplayed a little bit. It's important to Michigan. So the Arab American vote in Michigan is about 1% of the population. The bigger, and I'm not, that's not to say it doesn't matter, because I think that conflict and that what's happening, and particularly with kind of the pro-Palestine vote among younger people, now you're talking about impacting Ann Arbor and East Lansing and like all the college towns and whether or not the Democrats get the margin they need out of younger voters. And then also, I think there's a real question even around Detroit and Wayne County about the black vote and whether or not, you know, look, Joe Biden's going to win the black vote. Joe Biden's going to win Wayne County in Michigan. But Hillary won Wayne County too, right? It's a question of what you win it by. And a lot of people don't realize this, but, you know, the African-American vote, Trump did slightly better in the city of Detroit in terms of percentage. I mean, it's nothing significant. He went from like 6 to 8 or something. It's insignificant. But still, you could say percentage-wise, he did better. However, even as he did better percentage-wise, he did not do better in terms of raw vote because so much more turned out. When Detroit turns out, look, Democrats for years in Michigan, now it's changed, the population has changed and moved around the state, but Democrats have lived and died with getting the vote out in Detroit. And when they don't get it out, they struggle. And I think if I were the Biden campaign, I would be working my butt off to get that vote out in Detroit. I'd be really working hard on that. And I'd really be working hard to make sure you get the young vote out. You know, the youth vote in 2022, now abortion was on the ballot, obviously, in Michigan in 2022. The youth vote went crazy in Michigan. It was the highest turnout among 18 to 29s anywhere in the country. If they could get those kind of numbers again, if you're the Biden campaign, you're probably feeling pretty good about that. But right now, I teach a little bit at Michigan State. I don't see the enthusiasm. Now, it's April. Kids don't tune in until later. But if I were them, I'd be concerned about what I'm seeing there right now.
Oh, very insightful information. I'm going to pass it on to Catherine and then Tim for some more questions. Catherine?
Sure.
Hey, Dante. Thank you for talking about college towns, because that's one of my questions. But I want to just comment on the decrease in voting in like the Detroit metro area. Do you think that has anything to do with the lessening of the impact that unions have? Because I think, I mean, when I was growing up in Michigan, my mother was a big activist in the Democratic Party, and I felt like the unions did a lot of that work.
Yep.
And I just wonder if they're, you know, that they're not as strong as they were. Do you think that has had an impact, and can we recover some of that?
So that's a really good question. The numbers are down. They're still down. I mean, compared, they bumped up a little bit in 2021, I want to say, or I think they bumped up a little bit in 2022, and then they're back down again in 2023. The numbers are, compared to what you're talking about, are just that, you know, they're a shadow of what they used to be. They're just, they're tiny. Now, the one thing that happened is when the Democrats got the trifecta in the state, they got the House, the Senate, and obviously Gretchen Whitmer in the governor's mansion, they were able to repeal right to work. Now, the question is, that only took effect in February of this year. Does that mean something going forward? I mean, that's not a lot of time, but does that mean something going forward? I don't know. It may lead to like some organizing campaigns. I know I've talked to some union people there. They're very excited about, while everybody is like, you know, terrified about what electric vehicles are going to do, because, you know, it's fewer people you need to put together an electric vehicle than an internal combustion vehicle. They are unionizing the battery plants there, and they're very excited about that. The unions are. That could be a big issue that could get them on their side. But the one thing I would say in general is there's this difference between what the leadership in the union wants and what the rank and file wants. And sometimes rank and file union voters can be somewhat socially conservative. Sometimes Trump's kind of rhetoric can appeal to them, even when the policies really don't make a whole heck of a lot of sense to them. But, you know, I grew up there too. And I grew up in the '80s, and I watched all the car jobs go away, the auto jobs go away, and the plants. And, we knew they weren't coming back. I mean, we knew it at the time. We knew it at the time because it's not just they're all going overseas or they're going south. It's like, well, that's part of it. And some of them are disappearing to automation. And like, this is the changing nature of the economy. This is what's happening to the economy we live in. And we got to figure out what to do about that. But they got angry at the Democrats for that, because for years the Democrats promised them they'd bring their jobs back. And even as I was growing up there, my father was a teacher. We'd talk around the dinner table. He taught these kids. He'd be like, those jobs aren't coming back. He's like, he taught government and political science. He knew the economics of what was happening. The thing that's interesting to me about it is they're angry at the Democrats for that, which I get a little bit. But then they support Donald Trump, and he's basically saying the same thing the Democrats have said for 40 years ago, saying the same thing, like, I'm going to bring your jobs back. And for some reason they believe it, and it's just like, it's just not that easy. You know, presidents don't control the economy. They can't wave a wand and bring back an economic sector or bring back jobs that have been replaced by automation. What,
in fact, what they actually probably support that, because it's, you know, innovation, it's advancement, and
it's change. Yeah.
Yeah,
I mean,
it's change. And people don't
like to hear it, but that doesn't mean that we should abandon people who work for unions. We have to help the people who work in the plants. We have to make sure that their kids can have the lives that they want them to have, and that they can have the lives that they want to have. But that's work. And the thing is, to figure out the way to do that is actually, it's not as easy as waving the job wand and bringing the jobs back. It really requires a lot of thinking and a lot of policy. And frankly, when I hear politicians on both sides talk about this, I don't really hear the ideas that are going to bring the jobs back, other than, like, you know, let's grow the economy, grow manufacturing jobs. I don't think anybody's opposed to that. I think that's great. But, you know, getting back what we had, you know, look, anybody who's running for office promising to turn the clock back, I think, is just like, you know, that's a very appealing message for a lot of voters. But anybody who's studied history knows that, you know, it's impossible. We can't.
Right.
We're not going to bring back the 70s. We're not going to bring back the 60s, and nor should we, right? The world has changed.
Yeah, well, I always use the analogy that when I was growing up, now I'm older than you, I grew up in the 60s, and, you know, I always thought, well, computers are going to bring us, computers and automation and innovation and progress is going to increase our level of decrease the amount of work we have to do, like work, you know, labor, and increase our time for creative and social endeavors, right? Because that's what we were promised.
Right.
But instead, what has happened is that everybody, all the big shots are making a lot more money because they've figured out a way to not have to pay people as much, or not as many people, I guess is more accurate.
Yeah.
And
nothing really changed. I think it's
for
both,
work.
Really. You're right.
Yeah. But so that's the thing that kind of troubles me is, like, why is it that automation hasn't given us more free time? Right? I mean
it's made us more efficient.
It's a long conversation, obviously.
Yeah, it's a really good question, though. It is. Like, because it's definitely taken the jobs away, because I've toured the Rouge plant. I toured the Rouge, where they made, when I was a kid, they made Mustangs. Now they make F-150s. I toured it as a kid, and then I toured it with my kids. And it's just half the number of people working there than there used to be. And they're producing as many cars as ever. They just don't need as many people to do that. And the people who work there will tell you that the plants of the future, you know, quote unquote, they have even fewer people working in them. And like, so look, these are questions. You know, it is just, you know, quote unquote, this is just progress. This is just the way things are. Sure, that's all true. But like, you have to find a way to make that work for people. Because
you have to add, you have to bundle in with progress. You have to bundle in something for the people who are getting, you know, lost in that shuffle.
Yeah, absolutely.
To me.
Absolutely.
Okay,
you
have a,
gotta give them ways. Yep.
I have a couple other questions for you. I don't
want to
dwell too much. I was interested in, when I was reading some of the analysis in your on your website, I was interested in the broadband access.
Mm-hmm.
I read, I don't know, I looked at like 3 or 4 different categories.
Yeah.
And it feels like broadband access is, well, of course it's really important, but I'm just wondering how that broadband access, how that informs education and sort of access to better jobs, better lifestyles, access to jobs, access to healthcare, you know.
Yeah. You're really speaking my language. We actually have a post that's going to go up in the next week or so now. It's written. We're just putting the final touches on it. We got beyond just looking at who has broadband access to looking at broadband speeds by type. And when you get to the broadband speeds, you see stark, stark differences. And it really raises serious questions about some of the stuff you're talking about. Because to say that, like, you know, the vast majority of everybody in these communities has access to broadband, it's like, sure, but how do you define broadband? And, like, what do we need broadband to do increasingly? Because, you know, frankly, the speed – you know, the speed has to keep rising because we're leaning heavier and heavier, more heavily on these networks. And it's a really good point. Like, you're going to have, what if you've got kids doing classwork at home and you've got 2 kids on computers or iPads or even on their phones, which is some kids have to do this on. Then you've got a parent watching television and you've
or
got all this.
Home.
Yeah, exactly. Or, exactly. Yeah, absolutely. Doing a Zoom call. And you've got all these like devices, just kind of like, you know, smart appliances, like sucking up broadband. We looked at it, and there are real concerns out there. The post will come out in the next week and a half, 2 weeks now. But like the numbers in there are concerning, particularly in some of these communities, and really concerning, most concerning in the rural communities. When we looked at it, some of them are really like, we looked at the numbers and we're like, wow, this is what the median really is in this place. This is what the median kind of speed is. What folks are able to do in these homes is somewhat limited. And like, and obviously the places around wealthier urban areas, their speeds are, you know, their median speeds, internet speeds are really fast, lightning fast.
Right.
And so they can have much more on there. But like, these are questions we have to figure out because, you know, this whole idea that anybody can live anywhere and isn't it wonderful you can work from home and like, yeah, that's only true if you've got the devices you need to do it and you've got the speed, the broadband speed you need to do it. And it's not evenly split up in this country. It's a real concern when you look at the data.
And it's not just economic, right? It's also just infrastructure. Is that true?
It's the infrastructure. That's right. Yeah, that's where the wiring is. I mean, some places just aren't wired for this kind of stuff. Like what?
Right.
You know, how big is the pipeline that's going into a home? You know, a digital pipeline that's going into a home. And some of these places, it is still, you know, you're still talking fairly small amounts of data coming through that pipeline. And it's a real concern. Yeah, I mean, we looked at these, somebody shared these data with us. It was a gentleman at Google, and we were going over it. And when we looked at the access numbers don't look bad. But when you get to the speeds, like, okay, well, what are these people able to do? And it's like, whoa, wait a minute. Like, there's a lot of disparities here, and this is a real problem. It's something we're going to have to focus on more. Again, this is another thing we're going to have to worry about over the next 5-10 years in this country.
Okay, I have one more quick question before we turn it over to Tim.
Sure.
You mentioned when you were talking with David, you mentioned some concern about college towns and the Palestinian.
Yeah.
And I'm actually a little concerned about college towns, too. I'm not – it's mostly anecdotal, but I'm a member of a – you know, Facebook group that's all Ann Arbor people. And
uh-huh.
I feel a sense of, I mean, I grew up there and I, you know,
sure.
It was always like the, you know, we were the first place to have, you know, third party elected people on our city council. And now I feel like it's really getting more conservative. Now it could be just anecdotal, but I'm feeling it. And I'm just wondering if that's true.
If you're seeing
that in college towns.
So I'm not so worried about college towns. The concern for me, if you're a Democrat, the concern in college towns, I think, is less about them getting more conservative. Though there are smaller college towns that are much more conservative than, like, you know, Madison or Ann Arbor or
right.
Bloomington, right? University Park. Like, there are places that are more conservative than that. But for the most part, the big college towns are still fairly liberal. The big challenge for them is getting the vote out. I mean,
right.
Like, college students, a lot of times, they tend to vote more in presidential years. They're terrible in off-year elections, for the most part, and midterms. They just don't turn out. Like, they don't turn out for it because they're just not focused on it. They're living their lives. They've got a lot going on. You know what it's like being a college student. You know, your world is the world
well,
around
I never
you, your friends.
Vote. I never didn't vote.
Same here. But I knew it was hard to get people to vote. I remember
yeah.
voting in college and just being like walking right up and voting like, where is everybody? But there was – so the abortion issue can be an issue that really motivates Democratic voters in those places in particular. But the big issue is getting them off the couch. You got to get them off the couch or the futon in this particular case maybe. And get them off the futon and get them into the voting booth. And that's not an easy thing.
I do think that the new Biden ads are targeting that better than they have in the past.
There's not a lot of Biden love on college campuses that I can hear, but there is still, I think, a lot of discontent about Trump. And, like,
mm-hmm.
that's the thing that's going to ultimately, I think, if the Democrats get the vote out in those places, it's going to be ramping up, you know, there's not going to be a lot of, like, huge pro-Biden support, but I think there's going to be a lot of anti-Trump vote in those places. But Democrats got to make sure they get that kind of primed and get this worked out. Because I do think in the rural communities, the Trump voters are going to come out. The Trump vote is what it is. I mean, it's not a majority, I don't think, but it's big. And it's enough to, you know, it's enough to win a state if you don't get your people out.
Okay, thanks so much. This is I love the work that you're doing and
oh, well,
really appreciate it. And I'm passing it to Tim. Sorry, Tim, I took too long.
Oh, you're fine, Catherine. Good evening, sir.
Hey.
In the stuff I was looking at, different groups of voters in these counties were presented with three statements.
Mm-hmm.
They were asked if they agreed with these statements. One of them went something like, "These days I feel like a stranger in my
yeah.
own country." Another one was like, it's increasingly hard for somebody like me to get ahead in America. And the third one was something like, national leaders don't understand me or my problems.
Yep.
And in all three different questions, by a pretty good margin, too, it was evangelicals who agreed with these statements more than any other group did. Now, is that because of, like, what we would call the politics of victimization? What is going on there with that?
I think they look – I think – so we had – we work with Ray Suarez. And Ray actually went off to explore this question in particular, because the nice thing we can do is we do the poll, and like you say, like those – the evangelical hub scored high on all those questions, very high. But then because what we do is based on actual places and on geography, we can go out and explore what those numbers look like. So we sent Ray to southwestern Missouri down by Branson.
Branson.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And he asked them this question. He asked them about, because they scored really high, and some days I feel like a stranger in my own country. And they, for them, for the people in those communities, it's a question of what they see in the media. And I do think that, like, but for them to say, I feel like a stranger increasing in my own country, that's a pretty strong sentiment. I will say that increasingly, and you guys know this because you look at poll data too, like the number of people who are not religiously affiliated in America is continuing to climb, right? What we call nones, N-O-N-E-S, like nones. They don't have any affiliation. That's climbing. Mm-hmm. So I think they look at those things and they're aware of them, or they look at what they consider to be popular culture and popular entertainment, and they feel that the Christian viewpoint is not represented enough, and that's I think where that's coming from. And at those communities often feel, you know, that somehow they've been, I don't know if they've been left behind, but they don't approve of the direction the country is moving in. That's been a pretty strong point of view for those communities for quite some time. So to us, there were some questions on this poll we asked, and we asked them because we knew we'd see, okay, we should see real differences on this. So that question you're talking about, that stranger in my own country, they were in the community. They were 60% of the people in those evangelical hubs said they felt that way. So we thought we'd see stuff like that. There were some other things that were a little more surprising to us. For instance, the idea that the economic system is rigged against Americans or rigged for the wealthy. Every community type agreed with that, which we found kind of interesting. Like the idea that when we look at these data, it's funny you focus on the evangelical hubs because they are one to focus on. All the cultural issues are the issues where we have steep divides in this country. If you focus more directly on the economic issue, particularly on what we'd consider to be fairly populist economic stances, we were surprised the amount of agreement. We really were. We didn't expect to see it, actually. Because, like, some of these places really are fairly well off. You know, they're not everybody in them. Not everybody in the urban suburbs is wealthy. Not everybody in the exurbs is wealthy. But they do pretty well compared, you know, the median is pretty good compared to the nation as a whole. And they all think the country, you know, the economic system is rigged for the wealthy. That's interesting. Mm-hmm. And what that does tell me is if we could get beyond some of this cultural stuff, there's room out there to get some things accomplished. Now, the devil's always in the details, of course. What do you do about these things? But that's kind of interesting. These cultural issues are the ones you're talking about, are the things that get in the way. And they really mean that it's hard to get anything done.
Yeah. So you had mentioned earlier in this segment that those who chose the counties this year were targeting more swing counties than in the past. And I agree with you. This is a turnout election, and that's really why I'm going to ask you this question. In this era of ultra-partisan politics, even in these swing counties, I would imagine that the number of undecideds that y'all are encountering in your interview process is extremely small. Is that a fair statement?
Very small. It's a little higher right now maybe because, you know, look, if you get somebody and they voted for Trump twice, so they voted for Hillary and Biden, And they're like, well, I don't know what I'm going to do in 2024. You kind of, I mean, you don't roll your eyes, but inside your head, you know, in your mind, you roll your eyes like, really, you don't know what you're going to do. But I do think there's a little reticence right now for people to choose a side just because they don't like the choices they have. But for the most part, when it comes right down to it, people know where they stand. I mean, what's left? These are two, what is left to know about these two candidates? It's like, and look, I'm not going to go against saying there should be debates. If you want to debate, they should debate. But, like, you know, the media is like, we need to have debates. And, like, I'm for having debates too. But, like, part of me is like, what is left to learn, man? Like, there is nothing left to learn about these two candidates. Like, there really isn't. Like, if you don't know who Joe Biden and Donald Trump are, I mean, you know, have you been, what rock have you been under? You know, we're rerunning the 2020 election, but it's not like, you know, it's not like, wow, Joe Biden and Donald Trump, huh? I'm really unsure who these two guys are. That's something nobody should ever say. I mean, we know quite well who these people are. And so people are, I think, to your point, in the end, do they know the way they're going to vote? Yes. To me, the bigger question is, are they going to vote? That's the real question. Are they going to come out and vote or not?
Yeah, I want to ask you one final question about something you wrote, as a matter of fact, something mm-hmm. that you researched personally. It seems that cutting social programs in order to lower taxes did not exactly get much love at all anywhere from among any group. And at the same time, in Washington, we see a growing chorus of people who says, in order to balance the budget, for instance, everything should be on the table,
right.
You know, even, you know, and that's totally detached from what the average person in this country believes then, isn't it?
Yeah, that was, when you talk about the surprising findings in this poll, that was one of the biggest surprises to us. The fact that everybody agreed on that question, which was to say that nobody was in favor of it. The phrase was, or the statement was, the U.S. government should cut social programs in order to lower taxes. Not only did no community type get over 50% on that, no community type got over 40% on that, which means there is just not a lot of interest in cutting social programs right now. And now I'm sure there's always interest in cutting taxes. Like, yo, you mean I pay less? Great, I'm almost for that. But, like, you know, the surprising lack of interest in cutting social programs, I think that's new. And, like, so we actually went and did a roundtable down in Florida, in Marion County, Florida. We sat down with Graying America, because Graying America votes very Republican. But on this question was one of the lowest scoring communities. Only 25% of the people in Graying America said they agreed with that statement. And we heard the same thing down there. That people, when you ask them, they're like, you know, no, like, the program should work better. But even if the idea among the voters we talked to is like, it might even cost a little more to get these programs to work properly, but that's okay. We shouldn't cut them. We need help. People need help. There's an understanding that people are struggling. So the idea of cutting social programs, there just is not a lot of enthusiasm for it right now, which is, again, this is a change of heart. This is something we haven't seen, I think, as much in the past.
Well, very interesting. With that, sir, I'm going to throw it back to David. David?
Yes. Well, Dante, thanks again for joining us. Incredible, insightful information you shared with us, of course, the work of the American Communities Project. If our listeners would like to access all that information, tell them where they can, I guess, see the site, and then if there's other places it gets posted.
Please go to AmericanCommunities.org. You can see the top. There's something in there that's just the website, and then there's something called the Story Bank in there. Click the Story Bank, and there's a huge story that has all these poll findings in it, and then lots of stories we've done, raised pieces in there, and some other place. You can click through those stories in the Story Bank, asking these questions to people on the ground in these communities. It's a really good place to see the work we do, just AmericanCommunities.org.
Yes. Well, keep up the good work, and we'll hope to get you on again in the future, maybe either right before or right after the election, because you're going to be the person that's either going to have the data to tell us what's going to happen or why what happened happened.
I don't ever like to tell anybody what's going to happen, but I don't like predicting. But I will say this. I really do think that the media's job should be, the media's job needs to be, when the thing happens, explaining what happened. I think we spend too much time trying to predict and not enough time trying to explain. And I think that's what we think our mission is anyway.
I think you're right on that. All right. Well, you have a good evening, sir.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Dante.
You, sir. Happy to join you guys. Bye-bye.
Right. Dante Cheney of the American Communities Project. Obviously, go look at their site. Follow Dante on social media. I know he's on LinkedIn and Twitter, probably on Facebook and several others. But really just insightful information. That's why so many media sources, including us, get a hold of him. We got time for one more topic, and one we've been trying to talk to for about 2 weeks, because either this issue is going to be this major big deal or it's going to be totally nothing. And right now we don't know which it'll be. And that is that at least two states, that being Alabama and Ohio, right now, if they followed the letter of the law and did not grant a waiver, which they have in the past, as recently as 2020, in Alabama's case, that Joe Biden or a Democratic nominee would not appear on the Ohio and Alabama ballot. Tim, how do you think this thing's going to turn out, if you had to guess?
Well, both states have deadlines, as you mentioned, for appearing on the ballot that precede the Democratic convention this year, which is from, I believe, August 19th through the 22nd. So, the president and vice president are not yet formally nominated. Republicans run both of these states, guys. The Biden campaign has formally asked the Secretary of State in both states to accept what they call provisional certification of the president as the party's presumptive nominee. Now, Alabama did exactly that for Donald Trump in 2020 when the Republican convention went last. Montana, Oklahoma, and Washington State did it for both candidates in 2020. Oklahoma's already said it's going to do so again this year. But who knows what will happen in Ohio and Alabama. We're in a very partisan era. Republicans totally control both states. It seems that they're making a move in Alabama to do something. Ohio is the worry. It's not that the president's going to carry the state. He's probably not going to carry the state. But we've got a U.S. Senate race, and we don't want the vote depressed. And being that they have routinely done this before, they should do it again. Will they? You know what? Your guess is as good as mine there. I just don't know.
Yeah, obviously something needs to get done to bring the calendar in line, regardless of which party is having their convention in August, because there's always a convention in August. The party in power is going to go second. One's going to be in late July. One's going to be in mid-August usually, because you want to have a break or two between, honestly, for the journalists. To catch their breath, because they're really the only folks going to vote. But you know it's going to happen, so why not have it be like the Monday after Labor Day or the Friday before Labor Day or some predictable date in which you know it's going to be that way. Catherine, do you think that, like Tim said, the story is more in Ohio?
Yeah, I guess. I just can't imagine that. It just seems so childish. Say, oh, we're not going to make an exception this time. We've done it every time before, but not this time. It just seems.
Yeah.
I'm not saying they wouldn't do it. I'm puzzled by the. I just wonder what the take would be. Like, what will people think? Like, will they just think that it's stupid?
Yeah.
I don't know.
I think petty is also a very good word. It could have a thing where people see, well, my goodness, this is how the Republicans are functioning if they did that.
kudos to states like Oklahoma. I mean, who knew Oklahoma would be such bastion of mature bipartisanship?
Yeah,
or not
exactly.
In this case, even bipartisanship, just Republicans saying, even though, you know, Democrats constitute a very, you know, minority voters in our state, we're going to, you know, give people an open democracy there. I really think, even though Ohio is the more important state because of Sherrod Brown, think of the message you're sending in Alabama. Who, by and large, are Democratic voters in Alabama? They're African-American voters. You have this horrible history with George Wallace and others that really defines your state in such a negative way, and you could, you know, do another thing to break free from this, but you choose not to. How short-sighted in that case that you want to do that. But we will watch this because, honestly, if it really came down to the fact that Joe Biden wouldn't be in the Ohio ballot, would you rush and figure out some way to have a pseudo-Zoom convention that actually was pending and counted and made the real convention a pony show? I think you'd have to look at it because you've got to keep the main thing the main thing.
They are talking about that very thing you mentioned as we speak. The National Party is. They are talking about doing something like that.
Yeah. You've got to because, you know, the first Tuesday in November is paramount. It's A through Y. You know, Z is the National Party Convention, for both parties, for that matter. Well, we want to again thank Dante Cheney for coming on the show. Next week, we've already got our guests lined up. We already knew Arizona was going to be a big deal. Then, of course, I'll call it the 1864 ruling was handed down, and I think that just made Arizona that even bigger of a state. It may be the key state in the Sun Belt strategy, if we will, and it has a Senate seat as well. And so we're going to have John Ryder, our expert from the state of Arizona, who's joined us in the past, come on again this coming Sunday next week. But until then, it's been the Kudzu Vine. Night, everybody.
Good night, guys.
We are the heirs of that first revolution.
Will a strong and united America still be a force for freedom and